Is it excessive spending or a nonprofit organization running like a business? The board of Jacksonville-based Wounded Warrior Project has asked independent advisors to review the charity's finances following claims in national media of bloated salaries and over-the-top events. Good morning, live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Karen Fagans, in for Melissa Ross. And just ahead, reporter David Bauerlein from the Florida Times-Union is with us. His front page story in Sunday's TU investigates Wounded Warrior Project's fundraising and spending. You can join the conversation this morning at 549-2937. We'd especially like to hear your thoughts if you've received services from Wounded Warrior Project or if you have worked at the organization. Also this morning, a delicious discussion about the First Coast dining scene. Let us know your favorite new restaurant or food trend. Plus, the UNF Chamber Singers plan a trip to Portugal. And as the Jaguars begin an important free agency period, Cole Pepper is here to talk sports. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, both CBS News and the New York Times in January released reports critical of the Jacksonville-based charity Wounded Warrior Project. They spoke with current and former employees who allege the charity funds lavish company retreats, expensive travel, and spends too much money on its image instead of on veterans. CEO Stephen Nardizzi has said those investments in fundraising and marketing are commonly used by for-profit corporations. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times-Union has reported on the Wounded Warrior Project. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can join the conversation at 549-2937 or tweet me at Karen Fagans. And David, your investigation this weekend really looked at the fundraising, and Stephen Nardizzi has been quite effective at fundraising. In 2007, Wounded Warrior had just over $18 million, and that has ballooned.
It's really astonishing that a group that was able to develop that kind of a fundraising machine over the last decade, and they've really been able to grow in leaps and bounds to go from $18 million, as you mentioned, Karen, up to about $340 million in revenue in the most recent year available for their financial report. So it's been a tremendous success at being able to tap into donors of all kinds, of all sizes, in order to bring them on board with this cause and contribute money.
And supporters of Wounded Warrior Project often praise the impact that the organization is having. What types of services does Wounded Warrior Project provide?
Well, they describe a real wide range of services. They range from having a resource center where somebody calls with a question that might be about the organization, might be about seeking some kind of a service. So they're sort of an information clearinghouse. That's on the that ranges more of the high volume type of service. And then on the other end of the equation, you're looking at the Independence Project, which is really helping veterans who have really severe brain, spinal cord, neurological injuries from their time of service, where that's a much more intensive type of high cost service to provide help for those veterans.
And as the amount of money the organization brings in has grown, so has the number of veterans it's helping. I think you reported that they served 144,000 veterans last year.
Right. I mean, they can show that they are providing more of these services out there. So that has grown as well over the 10 years with the fundraising has grown. One thing I thought was interesting is that when you look at each year of their fundraising has grown extremely fast. Their spending also has grown each year, but always they've brought in more money than they've spent. So they've really accumulated a large reserve, over $200 million, that is money that's there. It's available to help for veterans. So one question for me as a reporter was just how are they going to use that reserve? It's a lot of money that's available for the services that donors have obviously given money for. So they going forward, I think it'll be interesting to see, do their reserves continue to grow? Can they kind of get the program impact to catch up, as it were, with this fundraising success? Having said that, they are adding programs, expanding the programs, but there's the gap between the fundraising and the expenditures.
Mm-hmm. Your story compared what Wounded Warrior Project is doing and the type of money they're bringing in to other nonprofit organizations. How does it compare?
Yeah, there's part of the CBS reports was looking at how there are some veterans organizations that have a higher proportion that goes to programs than Wounded Warriors. Charitable organizations really are all over the map in terms of how much of their money goes towards expenditures for fundraising versus programs. So I'm really not enough of an expert, to be honest, Karen, in the field to say, well, they're high or low. There just seems to be a tremendous range in terms of how programs are set up. There's certainly an organization that spends money to raise money. So there is this recycling or cycling of money that's raised, and that's used to raise more money. Mm-hmm. It's obviously how they've been able to be as successful as they have.
We're speaking with David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union about the Wounded Warrior Project, a Jacksonville-based charity. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. We're going to go now to Julie in Jacks Beach. Julie, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your question.
So it was just sort of perplexing to me that 60 Minutes, who is a program on CBS, reported, you know, those terrible things about Wounded Warrior, and yet one of their executives is on the board.
That is true.
Right.
I think they do mention that in all of the reporting that they do about the Wounded Warrior Project. David, you and I have worked in journalism and know that very often the business side of a media organization and the news side of an organization are completely separate.
Right. There is a wall of separation between the editorial and the business side. So, and they have mentioned that in ones I've seen in full disclosure type of comments that one of the board directors is a member as well of the CBS executive team. I think Wounded Warriors suggested they should have reached out to that executive. CBS, I think, has said that they tried to reach the CEO and get a comment or interview with him.
So, Julie, what are your thoughts on this reporting against the Wounded Warrior Project?
Well, I mean, I'm not an accountant, and I don't have access to their records, so I don't have an opinion. I think it's going to be a good thing to have it audited by an outside agency.
Thank you, Julie. And that's an important thing to point out. We did invite a representative from Wounded Warrior Project to be on the program today. They did not send anyone, but they did send a statement that points out their board is doing a thorough financial and policy review by an independent advisor, and that should be completed shortly. I think a lot of people are waiting to see what comes out of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that hopefully it will address head on the specific questions that have been raised and provide some clarity there. I think bottom line, people are going to be interested in knowing after that review, is anything going to be changed? And if not, why not? And if so, why? Because I think that's the fundamental questions that have been raised. I think donors would probably be interested in knowing that as well.
Again, you can join the conversation by calling 549-2937 or tweeting me at Karen Fagans. David, the latest CBS News report is that some big donors are cutting ties with Wounded Warrior Project and even calling for the CEO's resignation. I think a lot of people are waiting to see what will happen next.
Well, I think that's true. We reached out to some people locally. Southeastern Grocers, who is a large supporter, they've raised close to $4 million over the past year through events at Winn-Dixie stores for Wounded Warrior. They're still solidly in support of the program, feel like it does have benefits, that it's still something that's supported by their employees and their customers. Some of the other donors, it will be interesting to see. And it's not just the large donors, Karen. It's also that they have a tremendous amount of small donors, the people who come in and give a one-time contribution that's not in the thousands of dollars, or also contribute $19 a month, I think is the amount that mm-hmm. you see. So those are really key in terms of Wounded Warriors being able to sustain this fundraising growth they've had, is having those donations continue to come in. So, it gets back to the point of what will the report show. I sure hope it's made public, because I think there's a lot of public interest in it in terms of the review and looking at the particular things, criticisms have been leveled by former employees. Are they on mark? Are they not? And hopefully some more detail and breakdown of how some of these spending is done. Because it's very difficult sometimes when you read the IRS reports to really get a firm handle on how exactly is all the money used. Some more detail would be great.
Right. And some of the criticism about the amount of donated money that's going to veteran services comes down to how you account for it. And some of the fundraising can be counted as good deeds because it also raises awareness about what Wounded Warrior Project is doing. But if you take the money they're spending on the fundraising and the awareness away, it's a much lower number. It's about 67%.
Right, exactly, Karen. Yeah, this is something that I really didn't realize until looking into this, but there is something called joint costs, and the idea is that you can spend money for fundraising, but it also has another dimension to it that can be viewed as being educational, informative, raising awareness, then it can be counted as a program expense.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's... In talking to Raina Coughlin with the local North Florida, Northeast Florida Nonprofit Center, she was saying that there's really all over the map in terms of how these kind of costs can be accounted for. So, you know, certainly since I've been doing this story, I've just noticed, and maybe it's just because I was working on the article about Wounded Warrior, there are a lot of Wounded Warrior advertisements out there. You see them on TV, you go online, see them online. And those would be considered, or at least some portion of that cost would be considered a program cost. Well, that's not something that I would have thought is a program cost, mm-hmm. but in the nonprofit world, it can be counted in that way.
Well, there are two sides to this. There's the side that says, is that what a donor thinks they're contributing to when they give to the Wounded Warrior Project? Would they consider that a program? Then the opposite argument is investing in the brand, making sure people know what Wounded Warrior Project is and who they're helping, is the reason that they've been able to raise so much money to help veterans.
Right. So you give a donation to Wounded Warrior. Some portion of that donation is then used to pay for fundraising costs that then bring in more donations. And it's definitely a case where you can make the argument that to have that kind of growth, you have to spend money to raise money. And I think that's part of what Wounded Warrior Project's position has been, is that, you know, that to have a nonprofit that sort of just gets by is a model that in some ways hamstrings your ability to reach the number of people that you want to reach. And that so by spending this money on the fundraising, you ultimately are able to reach more people. To my mind, it kind of gets back, though, to the question of if you're raising the money and you do want to see that money then be put into programs. So it's matching up the growth in your fundraising with the growth in your program expenditures so that you are expanding, you know, at the same rate, at least, and being able to get that money where it needs to go, which is helping veterans who are obviously in a time of transition. And there seems to be no doubt there's a great need for the programs.
And just about the time these reports started coming out nationally, the Wounded Warrior Project did announce a new initiative. I think the timing was coincidental. But they are going to launch the Warrior Care Network, $100 million over the next 3 years, to help veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder at 4 medical centers in Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And we know that PTSD is one of the major issues for veterans coming back from recent wars.
Without a doubt. And the way the program works, obviously the... One thing that Wounded Warrior does is all its programs are free of charge. So the idea is that the medical treatment would be free, the travel costs would be free. It's covered for both the veteran as well as for the veteran's family members. So this is a program that, yes, it's a lot of what the veterans are facing who have come back from Iraq, Afghanistan, other military actions since 9/11 is the... They're sort of the psychological wounds of war. And so this would be an effort to try and expand the outreach to those veterans and give them more of the medical treatment that obviously can make a real difference.
All right, David, any final thoughts? It seems to me that a lot of this rests on this independent audit.
Right. And, you know, and hopefully it truly is independent and it does, it is made public. And that I think that will hopefully shed more light on some of the specifics, as I've said, going down maybe more of a granular type of detail of some of the accusations and charges. One point I will make, I just noticed in the intro there was a speaker talking about donors don't want money spent on alcohol. That is one thing that Wounded Warrior has said, is that the actual spending at these events and retreats does not include any spending on alcohol. Obviously, if employees want to drink after the event, they're free to do so. And I think those are a lot of the kind of questions that people want answered. Okay, one group says this, another group says that. Have somebody independent come in, really look at the details of these reports, look at the spending, look at the invoices, determine definitively, here's how money is spent, here's how it's not spent, and have the board look and see whether there's any kind of changes they want to make in terms of how this organization goes moving forward.
And then at least that way donors have the information and can make the decision for themselves whether this is a charity that they want to contribute to.
Absolutely, because there are a huge number of veterans groups out there, nonprofits that help veterans, and there's certainly a wide array of choices that people can make. So the more information they have, the better it is for them.
David Bauerlein from the Florida Times Union, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Karen.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, UNF's elite chamber singers join us with a preview of their new CD, and we'll talk UF and FSU's chances for the big dance. Culpepper will have all of the latest in sports. But up next, a discussion of the First Coast dining scene with food writer Karen Strybich. What is your favorite new restaurant or food trend? Give us a call at 549-2937. We'll be back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the American eugenics movement that led to a 1927 Supreme Court decision and the sterilization of tens of thousands of Americans deemed physically or mentally unfit. Minorities, the poor, and even promiscuous women were often targeted. American eugenics inspired the Nazis. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Adam Cohen, author of Imbeciles. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Whiskey. Quite nice in moderation. Probably not, though, the best new business venture.
When people call me, the first thing I say out the door is, if you get your distillery open in 2 years, I'll fly out and take you out to dinner.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the latest in our series I've Always Wondered, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT. Wow. And I'm bringing some friends with me.
Aerothang, with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Aerothang. It's a new show, because we going to do everything we want.
Aerothang, the opposite of nothing.
Sweden has taken in more migrants per capita than any other European country, and tens of thousands of these are unaccompanied minors.
They want to start school immediately. They want to work. They want to do something.
We meet the people helping to settle kids into their new lives. That story and the news out of an emergency EU summit with Turkey later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Karen Fagans, in today for Melissa Ross. Ethnic cuisine, locally sourced menus, and handcrafted cocktails are just a few of the dining trends we're seeing on the First Coast. What is your favorite new restaurant or trend? Give us a call at 549-2937 or tweet me at Karen Fagans. Food writer Karen Strybich keeps us in the know about all of the best places in her restaurant reviews for the Florida Times Union. She spent several years running the Bite Club at Folio Weekly. She knows all about food in our area, and she joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Karen, what is your favorite new dining trend on the First Coast?
I would say there's a lot of things on the horizon in Jacksonville, and the food scene has really blown up in the last couple of years. I think there's a big focus on local eating and locally sourced ingredients and fresh food. Chefs that really care and are changing the menu frequently based on what's in season. We see really interesting things like gourmet craft popsicles and cold-pressed juice and just these kind of small spin-offs that maybe before were found at another store, but now they're their own specialty shop or specialty food destination, which is really exciting. So those are some of my favorite smaller trends. We also have a new restaurant called Spraga & Company, which I really like. It's at 220 Riverside, so we've got some other restaurants coming in there. It's a top chef, and he's from Philadelphia, and this is his first restaurant in Jacksonville. Came to the area, really liked it. So exciting to see kind of that, you know, big city mentality coming to Jacksonville. And then just a lot of different places, everything from an expanded vegan focus on menus, and places like Southern Roots are doing it really well at Park and King and Riverside and trying to accommodate but also be approachable to everyone.
Well, let's talk about Spraga for a moment. The type of food they have there is Southern-inspired?
Yes, I would say Southern-inspired is a great way to explain. So small plates meant for sharing, which is different for some people. So sometimes people want to go in, they just want what they want, don't want to share. So it's really a communal experience. There's large tables. You can go with friends, coworkers, spouse, on a date, whatever, go by yourself as well. But it's really fun to try different things and be open-minded and try ingredients that are prepared in different ways than you've had them. They're not going to be the, you know, boiled Brussels sprouts of your youth. You're going to have really creative dishes with really interesting ingredients and flavors.
We opened up this conversation yesterday on my Facebook page, and we had several people mention Nacho Taco as their favorite new restaurant in the Jacksonville area. This is in the Riverside area, and I hear it's like L.A. Mexican food.
And I have sadly not been there. I've driven by it more times than I can count. It's just a really small kind of, not even a hole in the wall. It's just kind of a standalone, almost shack-like, very small, maybe one picnic table. So it's been kind of chilly, so I've been trying to save it for a warmer day. But yes, I've heard very good things. And that's an exciting experience, just small, grab and go. But people have been really talking about that.
Mm-hmm. And again, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 549-2937. We're talking with food writer Karen Strybick about food trends and all of the exciting new things happening on the First Coast dining scene. You mentioned Southern Roots, and this is a place I've heard a lot of people talk about. I don't know what it's all about.
So Southern Roots is, it's mostly vegan, and so they don't necessarily promote that because they don't want to scare off non-vegan. So, but the food is fantastic, and you can't judge a book by its cover. You have to go. You have to experience it. I eat there at least once or twice a week since it's open. It's been open for a year. My credit card tells me so. So everything's fresh. The owners use local ingredients whenever they can. They're organic, and that's their focus. But really fresh, bold flavors. So there'll be one special of the day and maybe a side or a soup. But it's just that one main item, and it's you can have it over greens, you can have it over rice or toast. And so there's three preparations of that special, and I always go for that. And they post it to their Instagram, they post it to their Facebook, these beautiful photos, vegetable-centric. And I go based on that sometimes, just seeing is believing, and I know it's going to be good. They also have a couple standard items on the menu that are there all the time that are also good. They serve coffee, Panther Coffee, out of Miami. And it's a really cool vibe. They also sell a lot of what they're serving, so they've got fresh vegetables, fresh flowers that are beautiful, bulk items.
You know, you mentioned toast. Toast seems like a trend.
Toast is definitely a trend. I think that started in New York and out in San Francisco and made its way here. And I think Brew was the first. And Brew is a coffee shop in Five Points. And so Callie Marie, she has a ton of creativity. She does a lot of gourmet toast. So she's doing everything from arugula and butternut squash and goat cheese to pepper jelly and kimchi jam. So there's a lot of collaboration in that too, because she's using local bread from Community Loaves, which is in Murray Hill. And then you've also got different collaborations with where the ingredients are coming from. So one of her, she uses a chocolate, I believe. I can't think where it's from, but it's a small batch company. So she tries to really play up utilizing small batch or local items.
And I mentioned the conversation we were having on Facebook. Craft bakeries was one of the trends that that Nancy White, another food writer, mentioned. She talked about Callie Marie at Brew, about Need Bake Shop, Sweet Theory Baking Company, Community Loaves, which you mentioned,
all
and Motion Sweets.
All of those. I've been to all of them. They're great. Motion Sweets does the small, colorful French macarons. So I know a lot of times people get confused, macaroons, macarons. So they are macarons. Macaroons are the shredded coconut cookies. And those macarons, everything from, I think they've done Cheeto flavored ones. They've done birthday cake. I had one the other day that had something with strawberry or red velvet, and it was fantastic. But just small grab and go. They recently rebranded. It's a really cool space. It's near Brew. Need is awesome. Need is Bold Bean. So many bold things in the city.
We are so bold.
Yes. So Bold Bean Coffee, when they first got their start, all of their baked goods were the brother of the owner. So he's branched out and he opened Need. And Need's got a great range of brunch items, lunch items, fresh baked bread. Really cool atmosphere in Murray Hill as well. And I think Murray Hill in and of itself is blowing up. We've got Carbro with all things carbohydrate.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, that's what I call it. But I could work my way down that street and back again and so many great spots.
And now we know that French Pantry is coming to Murray
yes,
Hill, where Edgewood
exciting.
Bakery has been for many years.
Bittersweet to see Edgewood go after all these years, but I think that French Pantry is only appropriate of a fit to replace the bakery, and they're going to try some new things. They're going to have a retail space, so you'll be able to go in, grab what you need, grab fresh bread, desserts, and then they're thinking about doing brunch and drinks or beverage service, and then possibly dinner, which would be really exciting.
All right. I know you want to talk about your favorite new places
yes,
in Jacksonville.
Let's hear it.
Give us a call at 549-2937, or maybe let us know what you'd like to see in Jacksonville, what you hope will come to this area. In our Facebook conversation, we had some people asking for new kinds of ethnic food in Jacksonville, and also the idea of something like a Chelsea Market here in Jacksonville. Be nice to see some of those developments.
And that is that's something that's in the works, so they should be announcing it soon. But
more to come. That's exciting.
Yes. So a food hall concept is on the way, and it seems that that's really, in a lot of the cities that I travel to, that's kind of the first place I go. I was recently down in Orlando, and they had two. One's called East End Market, and one's called Market on South. And both of these concepts house different food vendors, so you're able to try different things. You're in one spot. Sometimes they sell local wares like sauerkraut or pickles or jellies and jams, so you can grab those as well. So it's a really neat one-stop kind of dining experience.
We talked a little bit about Five Points being a very happening place for new food spots. We talked about Murray Hill, but Five Points is really coming into its own. A lot of
yes.
new things there, and a new seafood restaurant coming to that area.
Yes, Tamati Seafood should be opening very soon, and they've got a location up in Fernandina. And what they've done with the space, just based on walking by and seeing what they've been posting on social media, it looks awesome. I think it's going to be really well received in that area. There's not really anything else in terms of fresh seafood or seafood at all that I can think of right there. So just another attractive dining option to fit into the Five Points kind of
vibe.
Yes.
It's a very cool place.
Yes.
We'd love to hear from you if you live at the beach or in St. Augustine. What are some of your favorite areas to eat in those areas of town? Give us a call, 549-2937. Where do you eat on the outskirts of the Jacksonville area or in some of the surrounding counties? What are some of the best places for people to check out?
So I recently discovered Traska and Company, which is down in Ponte Vedra, but not too far from I'm near Avondale, so it's maybe 25 minutes for me, and it is fantastic. So really cool, locally owned shop. They do coffee, tea. They do fresh pressed paninos, which is kind of a sandwich / pizza concept. Pizza, great salads, make their own dressing. I was very impressed with that. I also really like, it was the Manatee Cafe, which is mostly vegan, but they are right on State Road 16, as if you're near the outlets in St. Augustine. Really mm-hmm. fresh food, had a great scramble and potatoes and coffee, and I had a chocolate silk pie. So everything Ooh. There is delicious. I'm always trying to find new ethnic places. I'm trying to think. There's Han Korean, which is near downtown. Off of Atlantic, and then you've also got San Juan Garden, which is on University, and both of those are really good if you haven't been. Some really interesting things. There's some where you can cook at the table.
All right, a lot of things going on. We do have some people on
Excellent.
Hold now. We're going to go to Lax, and Lax, it says that you are driving through the area. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I'm en route Miami to Atlanta, and when I'm on this road, I always make it my way to stop at the Caribbean Sunrise Restaurant on Main Street.
Wonderful. Yeah. What do you get there? What do you order?
Well, usually the oxtail.
Yes, good choice. You don't find that every day.
And it's on Main Street, two doors down from Andrew Jackson High School.
Great. We'll have to check it out. Thanks for the recommendation.
I think the address there is 4106.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Lax. Drive safely. All right. We'll go now to Alex in Atlantic Beach. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good morning. What is your favorite new restaurant or food trend in the area?
Well, I definitely like the vegan options, and I was excited to hear that the vegan restaurant that's been open for a year now, and I happen to miss the name of it, so I was just wondering if you could advertise it again one more time.
Southern Roots?
Yes, Southern Roots, and that's near Park and King in Riverside.
And also, we'll put together a list of the restaurants that we've talked about, and I'll get that up on WJCTnews.org later today. So if you missed a name or want more information, we'll have that a bit available for you. Thanks for the call,
All
right,
Alex. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too. We'll go now to Amira. Amira's in downtown Jacksonville. Good morning, Amira. Oh, and it looks like Amira may be gone. So we'll go next to Bubba. Bubba's also in downtown Jacksonville. Good morning, Bubba.
Good morning. I would like to tell you about my favorite restaurant downtown, and that's going to be Bay Street Bar and Grill. As far as, like, late night eats go, it's open till like 3 in the morning. And so if you're, like, downtown and you're looking for somewhere really awesome to eat, Bay Street is the place to go. It's like burgers and, you know, pizzas and stuff like that. They also have a full bar and everything, and that's definitely my favorite place to eat.
Thank you very much, Bubba. And Karen, a lot of people are excited to see more places opening up downtown, but specifically places open late.
Yes, and I recently frequented Spliff's Gastropub, which is right there next to 1904, and they're open late, but they're also open for lunch. Really nice in there, great food. You can go healthy or unhealthy depending on how you're feeling, but they do custom mac and cheese orders. They've got homemade hot pockets, which are really cool. Can't find that everywhere.
No.
And you've got places like Chomp Chomp that are open late.
All right, we got time for just a few more calls. Amira's back on the line. Sorry we lost you, Amira.
Hi. I am in love with Tamarind Thai. They're right there where Margaret and Riverside meet. It's authentic Thai food. They look great. It's like a really eclectic but comfortable environment, but the food is absolutely amazing.
Thank you so much.
Time is like super reasonable.
All right, we appreciate the recommendation. Thank you so much. We'll take one more call. This is Kevin in Ponte Vedra. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions or thoughts. So first of all, I agree with your guest today about Trasca and Ponte Vedra. It's wonderful. And then there's also another place I just discovered, Uptown Scratch Kitchen. It's a little just trailer right in St. Augustine on San Marco. It's wonderful. But my question was, you know, why don't we seem to have any good choices for Asian food here in Jacksonville?
Oh, that's an interesting question. And I think some would argue that we do. Let's see what Karen has to say about this.
I kind of agree with the caller. We have some. I was just thinking, there's not a whole lot of great Asian. I do like, in terms of Japanese, I like Kazu, which is in Mandarin. Excellent fresh fish. He's flying it in daily from Japan. I like Sushiko in Avondale. But in terms of Chinese, I haven't found a great Chinese restaurant. I haven't found other great Asian. So I'm with him on this one. I'd love to see some more.
All right. So that's one area where we might need to see some growth. But I think from this conversation, a lot of people might have a new place to check out or a few places that they'd like to try. Karen, thank you for being here and being a part of this conversation.
Certainly.
Karen Strybeck is a food writer for the Florida Times Union. And coming up, which free agents should the Jacksonville Jaguars target? Analysis from Culpepper in Sports. But first. The UNF Chamber Singers have an international trip coming up in the spring. We'll tell you how you can help them get there when we return. Thank you.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, the website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part two, sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Life under ISIS.
Anyone gathering in public without permission now risks being accused of plotting against Daesh.
One activist risks his life to share his story about the Islamic State's brutal reign of terror. Inside Raqqa, that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
The small community of Gotha is now part of the greater Orlando area, but it started out in the 1880s as a colony of German freethinkers. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll explore the history of Gotha. We'll discuss the first-person account of a French shipwreck on Florida's Gulf Coast and the Mosquito Beaters Club. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on The World, European countries each have their own way of handling incoming migrants. Belgium is encouraging some to go to college and to pursue a career. Not everybody likes the idea.
The Belgian attitude in general is still those people, they will come here, they will steal our jobs.
Belgium tries to harness the brain power of its new refugees. That and the news on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. I'm Karen Fagans, and this is First Coast Connect. An elite group of singers at the University of North Florida will soon go on the trip of a lifetime. 28 students in the UNF Chamber Singers will have the opportunity to perform throughout Portugal this spring, but the students need some money to get there. Joining us today is UNF's Director of Choral Activities, Cara Tascher. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Cara has also brought with her two members of the group, Brooks Baptiste and Anna Manns. Did I say it's Anna or Anna?
It's Anna, yeah.
Anna Manns. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
And they are both, I just learned, Jacksonville natives, Douglas Anderson grads, so very exciting. Cara, first of all, tell us a little bit about this group at UNF and who gets to be a part of it.
Well, the Chamber Singers is one of four choral ensembles at the University of North Florida, and this group has, this year, five or six. Mm-hmm. It's largely comprised of voice majors, people who can sight read, people who sing well together, and it's a very rigorous audition process at the beginning of each year.
So how did the opportunity to go to Portugal come about?
Well, it's important for every choral program to tour internationally. I think it's a perfect opportunity to expose students to life outside of our little tiny bubbles. This year, Portugal was chosen by the students. Actually, after they researched the cost of everything in Western Europe, we knew it was Western Europe, and they said, well, Portugal's economy is suffering a little bit. We can go help them, and that will help us. So it was one of the more affordable places. Plus, it has one of the richest cultures, and we've been doing some Portuguese Renaissance music by Frei Manuel Cardoso, and we'll be able to perform his music in the places it was composed, which is very
amazing. Exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think that a trip like this could be really transformative for students. What do you think you'll get out of it?
I mean, I feel so lucky to be touring with this particular group of people. I mean, we've spent so much time in rehearsals together, and we spend so much time together even outside of the rehearsal room. So I feel like we're going to be able to really translate our music in a way that's just going to be really natural and organic and will grow us closer to one another and grow us closer to our community and to this new community that we're going to be exposed to. So I feel really lucky to be touring with people that I hold so dearly, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Brooks, I understand it's about $3,500 per student. That's no joke when you're an undergrad.
Right.
It's a lot of money. So how are you as a group going about raising that money?
Right now, what we're doing, our new project is coming out in April, and we are super excited about it. It was something that we're going to be using to fundraise with pre-order sales. We've done many benefit concerts. We've done just a lot of different things in the community so people can get to know a little bit of who we are, and then we can share our music all at the same time.
So yes, they have recorded a CD. It's called Come By Here, and it was recorded at St. Paul's by the Sea Episcopal Church, a place with really great acoustics.
Mm-hmm.
They are taking pre-orders now. Let's take a listen. Beautiful. I think everyone's Monday just got a little bit better. Anna, the experience of making the CD had to be incredible in itself.
It really was. We had just actually finished up touring. We did a local-ish tour. We went just a little bit south in Florida and went to some high schools and did some concerts, just getting this repertoire ready for the CD. So at that point, we had spent a lot of time together, and it was just so much fun. I mean, we'd come in early in the morning, get some takes, go have lunch, come back. It was a really exhausting 2 days, but I think that it even brought us even more closer because we had spent all that time together preparing this repertoire.
All right, Cara, let's give out the information so our listeners know how to pre-order this and help you guys get to Portugal.
The best way to do it is just by emailing me at cara.tasher@unf.edu. That's Cara with a C, and then Tasher with no C.
Okay. All right. Cara Tasher leads UNF's chamber singers. Brooks Baptiste and Anna Manns are members of the group. Thank you so much for being here. Safe travels and enjoy your trip.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us. Culpepper is next with sports, but we're going to listen to a little more of that beautiful music before we go to break.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Democratic candidates hold what may be a pivotal debate in Flint, Michigan, where they stand on the latest issues from job opportunity to foreign policy and how their positions have evolved.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Aged whiskey. Quite nice in moderation. Probably not, though, the best new business venture.
When people call me, the first thing I say out the door is, if you get your distillery open in 2 years, I'll fly out and take you out to dinner.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the latest in our series I've Always Wondered, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Welcome back. I'm Karen Fagans, in today for Melissa Ross, who will be back on Wednesday. Well, the Jaguars begin a very important free agency period today.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper is here, as he is each and every Monday, with everything we need to know about the world of sports. Good morning, Cole.
Good morning, Karen. It is an intriguing time in the National Football League right now because they've changed the rules of late, and while you can't start signing free agents until Wednesday, you can start having conversations in about 2 hours and 9 minutes, noon Eastern time. Teams can start having conversations with agents of free agents. Now, I'm not here to suggest that any NFL team would ever usurp the rules and maybe shoot a text or have a backdoor conversation in advance. But
that's
we are,
not how things work.
No. Mm-hmm. We never. But we are hearing that there are already some players who are scheduling visits to different teams, remarkably, including one that the Jaguars could be in the mix on, Mario Williams, former number one overall pick. He's a pass rusher. His productivity in Buffalo wasn't quite what it was in his younger days, but certainly a guy who can be can add to what is the Jaguars' number one need, which is getting a better rush on the quarterbacks. So he's going to be courted by Miami and by the Giants. The Jaguars also appear to be in the mix, but I don't think he's going to be the only pass rusher the Jaguars entertain. In fact, they have more cap room to spend than any other team in the National Football League. So if they want to go out on a spending spree, they certainly have that opportunity to do so. And I think you're going to see a lot of activity from the Jaguars here in free agency, particularly on the defensive line and probably adding some depth on the offensive line and in the defensive secondary.
Yeah, it's funny. I was looking at ESPN, and they said the Jaguars have so many needs, it's hard to limit this to just one player.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily say that they, I mean, maybe in the grand scheme, this looks like a lot of needs. From where we've been the last several years looking at the Jaguars' needs, they have fewer. They don't need a quarterback. They don't need a wide receiver. They probably need another backup running back. They have some positions where they're in pretty good shape on. But, listen, if you haven't had a winning record since 2007, you have needs. And there are a lot of needs. But the one that's most glaring in this day and age in the National Football League, if you can't rush the passer, you're just not going to win. And a great example of that is the Denver Broncos, who had the best pass rush in the league. They win the Super Bowl, even though Peyton Manning was on the back end of his career, and he's going to announce he's officially retiring today. But that's just such a key. You've got to have a quarterback. You've got to have a pass rusher. You're not going to win in the NFL in this day and age.
All right, UNF, a tough loss in the Atlantic Sun Men's Basketball Championship against FGCU on Thursday.
Gulf Coast, and yet they still had a chance to make the big dance. So typically, in the Atlantic Sun, you're going to get one bid in the NCAA tournament. That's going to be the automatic bid to the conference tournament champion. But because Stetson was ineligible to go to the NCAAs but was allowed to play in the conference tournament, it suddenly created this very surreal situation that UNF had to root for Stetson to beat Florida Gulf Coast so they could get in. It went to overtime. Stetson had a chance. Gulf Coast wound up winning. They get the automatic bid. But there will be postseason for UNF. They will go to the NIT. All those games in terms of times and locations will be announced, and opponents will be announced on Sunday. Sunday will be Selection Sunday for the big dance, and then also after that in the evening, you'll have the NIT bracket rolled out.
So we're going to talk UF and FSU's chances. The Gators had a bad run at the end of the season, but closed it out with a win against my Missouri team.
Lowly last place Missouri.
Wah, wah.
They did, and a little bit of momentum. I really think, though, the Gators need to go deep and maybe might have to win the SEC tournament in order to get in. It's going to be very close. They've had an uneven season in Mike White's first year. You kind of expected that with some of the changes they've had in personnel and certainly in the terms of the coaching staff. The SEC also didn't help them out this year. Not a very strong year for the SEC. Even Kentucky was down by Kentucky standards. Mm-hmm. So the conference was not particularly strong. So I think Florida probably needs to at least get to the championship final and maybe has to win the tournament in order to get into the big dance because they've had a rough go of it here particularly at the end of the year. As you mentioned, they snapped a four-game losing streak with a victory against Missouri.
Also a tough road for FSU, right?
Yeah, and they're going to have to win the conference. I think 18-12 record overall and under 500 in the Atlantic Coast Conference. They did beat Syracuse to close out the regular season on Saturday, but they're going to have to go a ways to get things turned around. This has not been, you know, it's interesting that Florida and Florida State are down in terms of basketball, while JU and UNF are both up. And so I would love to see a time, and listen, you grew up in a school that has a fine basketball tradition. I grew up and went to Kansas, the great basketball tradition. I love it when there's a lot of teams with rivalries going on all at the same time. And you and I have talked about the Kansas-Missouri rivalry ad nauseum, probably more than you care to. But you know, when JU and UNF are really good, that's good for basketball in the city. And it creates a great atmosphere, as we saw this year with both of those games between the two teams.
Yeah, it was exciting. And it was an exciting weekend at the arena in Jacksonville with the SEC Women's Tournament.
Yeah, first time the SEC Women's Tournament had ever come to Jacksonville. And by all reports and all sort of reactions, very well done by the city and the Jacksonville Sports Council. And South Carolina wound up winning. They were undefeated in the regular season, wound up cruising through, beating Mississippi State yesterday for the title. It's interesting, though. I'm going to be interested to see what direction the Jack Sports Council and also the city take going forward. These sort of, it's not a top-flight event like a Super Bowl or an NCAA basketball tournament, but sort of the second-tier events that can bring a lot of folks in town in terms from an economic development standpoint. You saw a lot of Tennessee fans around town, by the way, this week. But does bring some attention nationally. Are we going to see more of those kind of events, or are we going to see more of the big events coming in?
All right, we got to wrap it up at the Armada on the road in Miami for a three-day training retreat with a friendly on Wednesday.
Yeah, 11 a.m. friendly, and the Armada regular season begins in April, and we're seeing some good things out of the attack for the Armada in Tony Miola's first year as head coach.
All right, thanks, Cole.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on Diane Rehm, follow the Democratic debate in Flint, Michigan last night. Diane and her guests will discuss where the candidates stand on issues and how their positions have evolved. I'm Karen Fagans, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.